Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Buntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Buntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of IGN Unfiltered, our monthly interview show where we sit down with the best, brightest, most notable people in the video game industry. My name's Ryan McCaffrey. This is a gentleman who, even if you don't know his name, you've felt his influence. His name is Ed Fries. He is one of the co-creators of Microsoft Excel. and then, in a more fun way, although Excel's fun for some people...
It's fun to work on.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that. You also, of course, ran Microsoft Game Studios during the original Xbox days.
Yes.
And were responsible for a lot of key acquisitions, including Bungie, Halo, etc. So,
yeah.
Ed, I want to start with the fact that you may be ultimately responsible, you specifically, may be ultimately responsible for the Xbox even existing today, because... as the head of Microsoft Game Studios back in the late 90s, early 2000s, you bought Bungie, who, of course, was developing Halo. And without Halo, would you agree that without Halo, the Xbox might not have survived without that killer app?
I think you're probably right. Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah, it's... but let's rewind a little more.
Yeah, okay.
Let's go back.
We'll come back to there.
The pit stop in the time machine. Yeah. Let's go back to early childhood.
Oh, wow. We're going way back.
Okay. Yeah. We're gonna do that.
All right.
I'm just curious. You fell in love with games early in life, didn't you?
I was researching. Really early. Yeah. You know, both my parents are technical. So my dad was an electrical engineer working at Boeing. My mom was a chemical engineer working at Boeing.
Wow.
And then she quit to have the kids. And then once we were old enough to stay out of trouble, she went back and got a master's in computer science. So doubly dad, computer science mom. She's working at DEC, Digital Equipment Corporation, old computer company. And so they'd bring stuff home, you know, for us to play with. So I grew up, like, soldering stuff together and making little, you know...
You're like the Tiger Woods. You're just right from an early age, just training from when you could walk.
It was weird around our dinner table at night, yeah, with the stuff we talked about. But my dad would bring home these programmable calculators with little mag tapes that would go through, little HP calculators that probably cost $10,000 at the time, you know. And I could play like Lunar Lander and Blackjack. And after a while, I started to, you know, reprogram them, try to make my own games, that kind of thing. And just went on from there.
So as you started to play games, was there a specific game that spoke to you that really sort of set into your consciousness and made you really know that you wanted to have games be a part of your life forever?
You know, it was more like, I loved games, but I also loved programming.
Yeah.
And so I loved both of them, and it took a while for me to put those two things together, and they kind of go in and out together in my life. So, you know, I really enjoyed programming, and it was like, well, what am I going to program? Games seem like a fun thing to do. So I started imitating games I'd see in the arcade. So I did Space War was one of the first games that I did. Well, I had gotten Atari 800 for Christmas one year. And so started programming it in BASIC and then learning assembly language, programming it in assembly. I did a Space War clone. And then...
All self-taught, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the way... And if you talk to people of my era, it's usually pretty similar. It's like we'd get these magazines in the mail, like Creative Computing or Antic, other magazines, and they'd have BASIC game programs. And you'd sit there and you'd type them in. And then they wouldn't work because you made a mistake on line 137. And you'd have to debug it. And you know, you type in enough of those and you start to, like, internalize how to make a game.
Right. You're learning a language, literally.
Right. And then after a while, and this is where you kind of drop off some people, at some point you realize BASIC's just not going to cut it. And you have to go to assembly language, which is kind of a big step. But when you're programming in assembly, you can really make the machine go fast and do stuff. So anyway, I wrote Space War, then I wrote a Frogger clone called Froggy. And, you know, I'm
totally not going to get you sued at all. No problem
exactly.
There.
So I'm a high school kid. I'm working at a pizza place. you know, and to make money to buy games.
Yeah, of course.
And we had the early arcade games there, and I play them at night, you know. Anyway, I make this Froggy thing, and it goes. There's no internet, right?
Of course.
So, yeah. And it just says "Buy Eddie Freeze" on it. Okay, it's Froggy by Eddie Freeze. I just made it for fun, right? But it goes around on some bulletin boards and finds its way down to California. And there's a little company down here called Romox. This would be 1981.
Wow.
And they were looking for game programmers, and they saw this thing, and they found me, and I have no idea. Like in 1981, how do you find, all you have is
phone
the
book?
Name.
Because your name's...
Yeah, but which phone book? I mean, they were in California, I was in Seattle. Mm-hmm. So somehow they found the right phone book to find the right...
Call the
Eddie
operator?
Freeze, who's a high school kid. I'm not listed in the phone.
That's true.
You know, I have kind of a funny last name, so that helps a bit. But somehow they found me, showed up, you know, will you write games for us? You know, just like, yeah.
Wow.
Yes, I will. I'm making pizza.
Just recruiting.
Yeah, exactly. So, so that was the start of my first part of my gaming career. I'll pause
that's
to let
like,
you.
Yeah, that's is. I don't know if that's just lucky or if that's just, you know, you're reaping. I mean, obviously, reaping the fruit of your labor there, but.
Right.
That's just astounding to me. So you join Microsoft,
and I just want to mention,
yeah.
you said that you're not going to get sued. Yeah, so they were worried that we would get sued. So they made me change it. They made me take out the cars. They gave it a medieval theme, basically.
Right.
And they changed the name from Froggy to Princess and Frog, and the idea was that you were a prince who'd been turned into a frog, and you had to
get
the
across
princess.
To her.
Yeah, and so I changed the cars to jousting knights, you know, and then. I couldn't really draw a princess, so I just drew a pair of lips, you know, that would move. She had to jump on the lips, and then you were. So anyway, so I made several games for them through end of high school and going into college.
Was it fun for you?
It was hugely fun.
Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. Because it combined the two things that I love, you know, programming and video games, right? So I'm going to college by then to get my computer science degree. Around 1984, the phone stops ringing. You know, the royalty checks stopped coming because the entire industry
crashed.
Went away.
Yeah.
Right? So I'm halfway through college. I'm like, you know, I got to get a job. I got to pay for college. So I started working in the computer center, running a Unix machine. During summer, I'd go back home and try to get a job during the summer. And summer of 85, I got a job for a little company called Microsoft.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I was just a summer intern working on computer-based training stuff, but they liked the job that I did. They gave me the nickname Fast Eddie because they said I was fast, whatever. So tried to get rid of that. I got rid of that pretty soon. I changed my name to Ed, so then the Fast Eddie thing, you know, didn't
that's
work.
That's right. It's no yeah. longer it's not going to fly anymore.
But they liked the job that I did, and so then they offered me a job to come back full time when I graduated the next year, 86, and that was to work on Excel.
Wow. So. Yeah. Yeah, you get your Bachelor of Science degree in computer science, but yeah, what are you doing on Excel? Because I think it's difficult for video game players. It's tough enough for us to imagine how games are made. Like we get these Vidocs and other things that sort of will show us how the sausage is made. But how do you even make Excel? What were you doing on Excel?
Yeah, well, I was really lucky. I mean, so. The year before, the very first version of Excel had come out on the Macintosh, okay? And then the team that I joined, we were taking that and moving it to Windows and adding a huge bunch of features and making the first Windows version of Excel. And I was the seventh programmer on the team and the most junior. I'm assigned to work for the lead programmers at what's called the technical lead. His name's Mark O'Brien, and he was like Buckaroo Banzai. For me, he was like, which is old movie reference, but I mean, he was a brilliant programmer by day, and he was lead guitar for a rock band called Green Ice at night.
Wow,
you know,
that's
so I'm just like, yeah, I got like stars in my eyes working for this guy, and he's really talented, and I learned a ton from him, he was working on some of the hardest stuff, and he would just like give stuff to me.
Mentored you.
Yeah, and so I would get exposed to a lot of the program, more than some other people on the team, like a guy who's just doing printing only learns one thing, a guy who's doing charting only learns one thing, but we were working all through the program. So, You know, so after the after we ship that version, a different guy becomes tech lead. We grow from 7 people to 35. And after we ship the next version, and I become a manager of a small team of programmers. You know, I'd been there a couple years. I'm running a little team. And then after we ship the next version, that tech lead leaves, and I'm the tech lead now. So I'm the lead programmer, and then it's 50 people.
Yeah.
So so that was fun. And challenging, but on the side, I'm playing games all this time because, you know, yeah. I love games, you know, and that was a great time for games, you know, I don't know. I'm putting together a talk to give in a few months from now, and I was just going through all the games that came out during that era, and it's like, you know, Populous and Civilization and Dune 2 and,
yeah.
you know, all these games that invented genres were coming out at that time.
Well, it's like you invented Excel. I mean, you reinvented office productivity. Do you ever stop and think about that? Like, because there was it was Lotus 1-2-3 was the sort of competitor that you guys were taking on at the time. They're gone. That's not a thing.
They were our huge competitor. That was a big challenge for us. They were the guy. I actually. When I graduated, I applied to a bunch of places, and I applied to Lotus, and I got a rejection letter from Lotus. So that always
you
sat.
Keep that?
Oh yeah, it always sat on my wall as we were working. And they were a bigger company than Microsoft.
I mean,
you think of Microsoft as huge now, but I mean, we had 7 guys trying to fight this company that was huge, you know. But you know,
are you ever on a plane and you look over and see somebody work in Excel on their computer, and you sit there and go, "I made that."
I don't know. I guess I'm used to it. Because
I would do that. That's
it
so
was.
Cool.
I'm not saying it wasn't cool. It was really fun. It was really fun. But it's not like why I did it. I guess I'll say that.
Yeah.
You know, because the satisfaction programming is really fun because it's creative and you have an idea and you try to make it something real and then something appears on the screen. You know. Whether it's a game or a spreadsheet or anything, it's an intellectual challenge that's just fun. You know, it can be frustrating when it doesn't work, but when it works, it's a great, great feeling.
Yeah.
So to me, that's more what I associate it with, those great feelings of making things work.
Do you still keep in touch with that mentor of yours? Did you get to show him the peak of like, I helped build the Xbox?
You know, he actually, that first guy, you know, he went off to, he left to go to Juilliard and study music.
Wow.
And he's an amazing musician. You know, my next boss after that left to move down to LA and became a painter. And he's a kind of old world oil painter. I mean, it was an amazing group of people that I got to work with at an incredible time.
Man.
So, yeah, I was very lucky to be around.
So, you end up as the head of Microsoft Game Studios, tasked with building a portfolio for a console launch.
Oh, man, just skipped 10 years of my life. Okay.
are there high? Well, you know, it's a gaming audience.
All right, let me fill in a
yes,
little
please.
Between that. Okay. Okay, so I'm lead programmer in Excel. My boss, we beat Lotus 1-2-3.
Yes.
But there's another big competitor, WordPerfect. Right?
I remember.
So my boss gets put over in charge of Word, but the next level up. So he's business unit manager. And he immediately gets in a fight with the development manager, the person who manages all the developers, and he leaves. And so then he comes knocking and he says, "Ed, do you want to come over and work with me?" And I like this guy. He was great to work for. So that was my next step up in my career, and I was managing the team of programmers on Word. And we were battling WordPerfect, which was another huge battle. They were way bigger than we were. And we battled for 5 years, and we beat them, and that was a whole another thing that maybe gamers don't care about, but it was important to me.
Well, I think most of us use Word or have at some point. I mean, it's.
But for me, it was more
about my whole career's been in Word.
For me, it was more about learning to manage a bigger team and
yeah.
and just kind of broadening my skills from just being a programmer, right? So at the end of that time, my boss had left, and I had a new boss, and anyway. It was time for me to go do something new, and they wanted me to move down to California and run PowerPoint. I didn't really.
You're just moving through the whole office portfolio at this point.
Yeah, it was natural. I could have just stayed with my career, you know, and done that. But it would have been as a business unit manager, so in a business role for the first time. And I'm like, well, if I'm going to look around, let me look around and see what else is out
sure.
there, you know. And I knew there was some a little group of people that were doing games in the company. I didn't know much about them. I was actually at the airport one day, flying somewhere, and I run into somebody at the. They were like, "Are you? You know, hey, did you know that we're looking for somebody to run our group?" You know, and I was like, "Oh, okay, that's interesting. I love games." So anyway, I ended up going interviewing for that job, and then what happened was everybody. A bunch of vice presidents freaked out, and they told me I was committing career suicide. They said, "Why would you leave office, one of the most important parts of the company, to go work on something no one cares about?" That's a direct quote.
Wow.
So that's why I didn't want you to skip that
last part,
because it's important. But I ignored them all. They let me do what I wanted.
Yeah.
Eventually.
Well, because you probably would have just left the company otherwise at that point.
I mean, I had earned a fair amount of political capital, maybe. So they're like rolling their eyes. All right, let Ed go off, do his game thing. I mean, they all knew.
He'll be back.
You know, whatever. He wants to throw away his career. That's fine. So I go over there. The first,
keep a list of those people to laugh at and just, you know.
No, most of them are friends.
Did you mail them all Xboxes later?
Anyway, maybe we can get there later. But so I go over, and it's a small group, really talented. A lot of them are still there, still doing incredible work. And, you know, they're showing me stuff that they're working on. They're like, "Oh, we're working with this little company down in Texas called Ensemble. They're making this real-time strategy game." And I was a big, you know, Dune 2, Command & Conquer, Red Alert player. And so I was like, "Oh, this is great. You know, this is so amazing."
Yeah.
And, you know, they have all this other stuff in production. I mean, but it's, you know, it's a small group, you know, 50-ish full-time people.
Well, it was kind of big back then, really, right?
Well, it was the size of my other team that was just programmers.
Gotcha,
so,
okay.
Although they actually, it turns out they had a lot of contractors that I didn't realize that at first. So the effective size was probably more like 150. But I show up and they're like, "Hey, we're going to Japan next week. You know, you want to come?" I'm like, "Yeah." You know, I've only been to Japan once more just with visiting a friend. So go to Japan, and it's like this, I mean, I'd literally just taken the job, and it had been, I was a little frazzled because, you know.
You're finding your bearings, right?
People are telling me I'm making this huge mistake in my career, and, you know, I think I'm doing the right thing, you know. But I'm there, and I'm walking down the streets in Tokyo, and we had just, you know, we went and visited all the great Japanese game developers, you know. I go in, and I see at Capcom, they're showing me this game they're working on. They call it Biohazard, which of course is Resident Evil. And I look at it, I'm like, this is Alone in the Dark. for people who know their game history.
Yes.
And they're like, yes, Alone in the Dark, you know, that's right. And I just remember very vividly walking down the streets of Tokyo that night and thinking, I made the right choice. Like,
yeah.
You know, at that point, I knew I had no more regrets. No
on
more.
The right path.
Yeah, I had done the right thing. And then, so then there's almost 5 years of building up our PC game business, you know, and so, bringing in, FOSSA, you know, Jordan Weissman,
sure.
His amazing team, MechWarrior, Crimson Skies, all that stuff, working with, Chris Roberts, starting Digital Anvil,
yeah.
You know, and, you know, I did what I think any gamer would do if they were somehow magically in the position of having a company with a ton of resources and people trusting them. It's like, I went and worked with everybody I could who I respected. It's like, "Oh, I love this game, you know, can I go work with Westwood?" We tried to acquire Westwood. We actually almost did that. EA outbid us at the last minute, but
it's too bad.
But you know, I went around, talked to everybody I respected in the industry. You know, I'd played Myth for Bungie, which helped later. But anyway, so we just built up the team through acquisition, and pretty soon we were like, you know, 500-600 people, and we're growing in the PC game development, you know, our percentage of PC game sales. And that's where Xbox comes in. So sorry, I had to.
No, it's okay.
I had to fill that gap in.
Yeah, does somebody come to you? Is it Robbie Bach at some point comes to you and says, "All right, we're going to do a console"?
No, not Robbie, not at all. So the guys who come to me are people like Seamus and Otto and those guys.
Yeah.
And they're like, you know, they're DirectX evangelists, right?
Yes.
So what that means is, you know, they work on the part of the Windows group. They work on the part of Windows that games use.
Yes.
So the gaming API for Windows. And they had this idea to make a console that was really a PC. At that time, the original pitch was, we're going to make this thing, it's going to look like a game console, you'll stick a CD in, and it'll install it quietly in the background, but it'll really be just a PC CD. And then it'll play like a console, but it'll really just be a PC game.
Wow, how full circle we've come.
I know, it's so crazy. True. It's so true how full circle. And anyway, so they, I had already turned down several other console-like attempts, by the way, in the company.
Interesting.
At this point. Like, an example is the one that was real, that historians out there will remember, is Windows CE on Dreamcast.
Yes. Okay. It was on the. It was stamped on the front of the
Dreamcast.
There
was a Windows
logo.
Yeah. Absolutely right. Did my group develop for that? No, because I thought it was not a real opportunity, not interesting, you know. And so I got to like decide what are we going to support and what are we not going to support. So they came to me and said, "We have this idea," and I liked it because I had this huge portfolio of PC games that I was developing, and this sounded like an easy way to get in the console business. This is the irony. You know, it's like, oh, this will be great because our developers all know how to develop on a PC. This will be a PC. And, you know, and so, yeah, this will be so easy for me because it would be a lot more work for me to work with Nintendo or Sony. And, you know, we don't really make the right kind of content and we don't understand those systems. And, you know, that's how it started. So, so I teamed up with them and there was another guy, Rick Thompson, who came in. He was going to run it for a while, kind of in the Robbie role, and then he ended up leaving, and Robbie kind of got drafted in, actually quite a bit later.
So as Xbox is spinning up, you've already been building this portfolio, but do you get a blank check effectively at this point and say, and told, okay, let's go build a launch lineup, go make this thing happen?
Eventually, yes. There's a famous story about the Valentine's Day Massacre, and I don't know if you want me to tell that story or not, but...
I feel like I vaguely know of it, but I'll bet our audience doesn't, and I could use a refresher if it's
okay.
A good story.
I'll try. It's a good story. I'll try to do the short version. So two things. There were actually two internal teams that wanted to build a console, okay? I teamed up with one.
Yep.
The other was the continuation of the Sega Dreamcast line. And they had a bunch of X3DO people there, and they wanted to do a console.
Hmm.
And their console was very much a pure console, you know.
Fully closed, platform, everything.
Exactly. Only had a CD. Ours had a hard disk. Ours ran Windows. Ours was a PC in disguise. Theirs was like a PlayStation 2. So that goes all the way up to Vice President, or all the way up to Bill Gates.
Wow.
You know? And we all have our vice presidents on our sides. It's like classic Microsoft battle, you know. And actually some of the ones on their sides were guys I used to work with on Excel, and we had ours, you know. And we have this VP battle, and Bill chooses, and he chooses us because we're more on strategy, Microsoft Terminal, because we're running Windows and all this stuff. Okay, then we spend a year figuring out what it's actually going to take to do this. And during that year, so their thing is shut down, and a lot of those guys come over and join our team.
Yeah.
You know, and the more we look at it, the more we like start to move more and more towards their direction. Okay. We don't go all the way there, but you know, at some point we drop Windows, you know, we're like, this is going to, you know, we really want this closed, you know, single process thing that's going to run really fast for games and blah, blah, blah. So anyway. So all of that culminates in this big meeting. It was on Valentine's Day where we're going to get the final approval or the project's going to get canceled.
Wow.
Okay.
No pressure.
You know, we've been through a lot of battles by then.
Are you sleeping that night?
Oh, yeah, yeah, sure. No problem. It's like the worst thing could happen.
You're confident.
The worst thing, no, not at all. The worst thing could happen to me is I go back and keep making PC games, which I love. So that's fine. That wasn't true for everyone on the team, by the way, but anyway, for me personally, it's okay.
Okay.
So, we go into the meeting and, 4 o'clock, Valentine's Day, Bill walks in, he's holding our deck, PowerPoint deck, throws it down the table and he says, "This is a blanking insult to everything I've done at this company," basically was the quote. That was the start of the meeting. And we all look around at each other. Actually, what we did was we all looked at Jay. We all turned and looked at Jay.
Jay Allard.
Jay Allard. Because we knew he's mad about the Windows thing. because we forgot to, in Microsoft terms, pre-disaster him. We didn't let him know that we had sort of. So anyway, so we all look at Jay, but Jay is not. He's like in shock for a minute, you know. So I start up and I try to explain, and he yells at me and shuts me down. And then Robbie steps up and tries to explain, and then he yells at him and shuts him down. Then Jay steps up and he yells at Jay and shuts him down. Anyway, and this goes on, you know. And then Steve Ballmer starts to get in, and he's going through our business plan, and it says we're going to lose a lot of money.
Yeah,
you know, and so he's beating us up about that. You know, why are we doing this? It's so expensive, and why, you know, blah blah blah. Hours go by. So it's 5 o'clock. It's 6 o'clock. It's 7 o'clock. Now this is Valentine's Day.
Yeah, you got plans.
Most of us have something going on, you know. So we're all looking around at each other, and you know, we keep saying, you know, we've spent a year looking at this. This is the best plan. If we want to get in, this is a machine we should build. It's a strategy we should use.
Yeah.
You know, and we just basically keep saying that over and over and over and over again. Finally, near the end, one of the guys who was just kind of an observer at the meeting raises his hand and he says, "What about Sony?" And
it's a ballsy guy to raise his hand when Ballmer and Gates are just breathing fire.
He was a senior guy, and he had been writing over the years a bunch of documents, kind of, because this was sort of his job. He'd write these documents saying, you know, Sony's like slowly invading the living room with processor here, memory here, yeah, hard disk here. If they put all that together, it could be a future threat to Microsoft, you know.
To living room.
Yeah. So he just says that. He says, "What about Sony?" This is about 8 o'clock at night on Valentine's Day. And Bill and Steve stop, and they look at each other. And Bill says, "Yeah, what about Sony?" Yeah, and Ballmer says, "Yeah, what about Sony?" You know, and then they look at each other, and then Bill turns and he says, "I'm going to give you guys everything you want. I'm going to let you guys. I'm going to approve this plan. I'm going to let you guys go off, do your thing. You know, I'll give you all the resources. I know you want to be separate from the rest of the company, so you're not bothered. I'm going to let you do that. You know, full blessing. Go do this thing." And then Ballmer basically repeats the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, 5 minutes. And then we walk out of there. And, you know, and I turn to Robbie and I say, "That was the weirdest meeting I've been in in my whatever then 15 years at the company." But we had full approval to do Xbox.
Wow. All's well that ends well.
Yeah, we had the blank check.
How many,
and that was February of 2000. We're shipping November 2001.
Yeah.
And I have to have a launch portfolio in 18 months.
So, that brings us to Bungie, I suppose.
It does.
What drew you to them? You mentioned Myth earlier.
Yeah.
Was it, you obviously liked Myth. You mentioned being familiar with it, helped out later. What draws you to Bungie?
So, you know, I'm a gamer, right? And so, you know, I had been going to GDC since, you know, 95 or something like that, and hanging with game designers that I liked and cared about. In the case of Bungie, the guy I knew was their business guy. His name was Peter Tamty. And so I knew Peter, but it's not like I originally thought of Bungie. What happened was one day my phone rang, not long after the Valentine's Day massacre, and I picked it up and it was Peter. And Peter said, "Hey, Ed, you know, we're kind of in financial trouble. We're thinking we're going to have to shut the company down or sell it to someone. We have an offer from Take-Two. Take-Two already..."
Published Myth, right?
Right. Take-Two already owns a third of us.
Yeah.
But we want to talk to other people too. Are you interested? And I'm like, "Yes, I am definitely interested." And he's like, "You know, we have this Halo thing we're working on. You know, we could show you." And I'm like, "I'm interested. I'm trying to build a portfolio for launch. We definitely should talk." And that was how it started. There was a guy on my team, John Kimmick, and he really drove the deal. And I had to negotiate with Ryan, who ran Take-Two, you know, to split up Bungie.
Yeah, figure out that part of it.
Yeah, so once I understood what they had and everything, it was like, okay, all I want is this thing they're working on called Halo and all the development team, you know. You can have, we'll finish Oni for you, which was another game they had in development, and you can have all their back catalog, all their older stuff.
Yeah, Marathon and
stuff. Yeah. So that was the split. So it was like, all I want is this one thing, Halo, and all the programmers and, you know, the team, and all you get, all you want is this. And so we made a deal, we split it up, acquired the company, and moved the guys out from Chicago out to Seattle.
Man, well, that worked out well.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm. As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Now, it's fairly well publicized at this point that I've talked to a lot of Microsoft guys that you guys weren't expecting Halo to be this killer app.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's kind of true. And, you know, we'd been in the game business long enough that we knew it was unpredictable. And we especially knew that we didn't know what we were doing in the console world. And people were constantly telling us, people like you,
shooter won't work.
People were constantly telling us that we didn't know what we were doing. You know, I don't mean you in particular, but I mean, you know,
I was still in college, Ed. Give me a break.
Anytime we talked to the press, they would say, you know, what's your Mario?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, well, I've got this Master Chief thing, but it's like, you know, it's like, yeah, and I'd show, you know, I'd show them games and they'd, oh, those seem like PC games, you know. And they're like, yeah, you know, and it's like, you know, and we're pushing this multiplayer networking stuff and it's like not really a console thing. The colors look wrong. Somebody's complaining about the colors don't look bright and cheerful enough, you know, and it's just all this stuff. And you hear it enough times, you start to wonder, you know, I mean, maybe we really don't know what we're doing, you know. But we knew we loved the game.
Yeah.
I mean, we were playing it a ton at the office. Everybody was loving it. But we go into E3 2001, and the console's still very much under development. The machines we had to show their half-speed graphics card at that time.
Yeah.
So everything's running half-speed. They try to show this multiplayer demo on the floor, and it doesn't really impress people. I had the single-player demo behind the scenes, and I thought it was really cool. But if you read the press from that time, it's very, I don't know, wait and see, you know. So we weren't sure. You know, at the same time, we were working with some console people, you know, Project Gotham Racing, Bizarre Creations. They had worked on a Sega title before that.
Yeah, Lorne Lanning.
Lorne Lanning, who I saw last night. Munch's Odyssey. So going into launch, you know, definitely Munch and Halo were, you know, from the marketing guys, you know, they're like, you know, experienced console team, well-known franchise, you know, or PC game in a genre. There'd only been one other first-person shooter on a console at that point, right? GoldenEye. So, you know, it's not just that it's a PC. It's just like an untried thing. There was a lot of skepticism. And even if you look, sometimes I'll talk about this. I show a Penny Arcade cartoon from the time where they right at Xbox launch, and the last frame is Halo is shit, and it shows a toilet seat. there was, you know, some people were saying stuff like that, influential people, you know, but as soon as we launched, the game, of course, became defining, took off, and, you know, and then you get all the, oh yeah, of course, oh yeah, we all knew that was going to be the case, we all knew it was going
to
be great.
That's what I wanted to ask you, is like, you know, some, whatever, 6 months later, whenever, it's just blowing up, it's taking off, does everybody at the company who maybe was any skeptic, are they all just like, just bowing before you at that point, like, oh, Ed, you went and got us this,
no,
this savior?
No. In fact, I have the opposite problem. I have the exact opposite problem.
How is that possible?
Which is that now Halo is too important, okay? Now everything, all the marketing people, all the planning, everything wants to revolve around Halo and the next Halo, and there's huge pressure to get the next Halo out and,
right,
and to rush it out. In the meantime, I'm like, my goal is to make more killer franchises. You know, we're doing lots of different things.
Yeah.
I'm always looking for great developers like Bungie, and they're incredibly talented, you know, but the way I'm going to make Xbox better is by doing more cool shit like Halo, not by focusing everything on this one game,
yeah,
this one team.
Just sucking it dry like a vampire.
Right, right. Which, of course, we've all seen happen to franchises before. I didn't want that. The Bungie guys didn't want that. They wanted to take their time and make the next Halo really
well, they
cool.
had, I wanted to ask you, they had two things in development that I've recently, over the years, and particularly recently, learned more about. There was Jason Jones a few years ago told me about a game called Project Phoenix. That was a Minecraft type sort of castle thing. You remember that?
I don't remember that particular one, here's what happened.
Yeah.
So after Halo 1 shipped, Jason went off with a small group of people to do some experimental things. And one of them was a Minotaur like
Gypsum. That was the next thing I was going to ask you about, because we had Marty O'Donnell on the show, and
he told
me about Gypsum.
So that one I remember.
Yeah.
I don't remember the other one, but where it fits in the timeline, I'm not sure. But what happened was, look, Jason is the heart and soul of Bungie. He always has been. He doesn't usually want to be up front, on stage, whatever, but he is the glue that holds that whole place together, even now. And when he was off, even though this team is super talented, imagine like super talented people in every category, you know, so like programming, art, production, all this stuff. But there used to be a guy, every time that they had an issue, they'd go to him and
with the vision.
This, yeah, exactly, the vision. That guy's gone, and now it's like a committee trying to run it, okay. And so they ran that way for a year, and then we reviewed the project, and it was really off the rails. And Jason said, I'm going to come back into that role, and I'm going to fix it. It's going to take a bunch of work.
Right.
It's basically another year to the schedule. So instead of being a two-year project, it's a three-year project. Mm-hmm. This was a big problem not for me. Well, it ultimately was for me, but a big problem for all the other people who thought that Halo should be the center of our entire universe. So this sort of leads up to why I left, actually.
Well, let's just go straight there. I mean, because I asked you about Gypsum and Phoenix, but I want to ask you about Rare, too.
Yeah.
We'll take a pit stop at Rare.
Let's do that.
Before you leave the company.
Let's take a Rare pit stop.
You played a big part in that. That was an extremely well-publicized, just a earth-shattering story.
Yeah.
When it happened for the game industry. But real quick, can you dispel an old rumor for me?
Sure.
And that's, did Microsoft ever consider or attempt to buy Nintendo? Was there ever anything to that old rumor? This is going to be good because you're taking time to answer it. You're gathering your thoughts. I like this.
When we first started thinking about doing Xbox, we met with Nintendo. And we sat down with Iwata and others, and we said, this is what we want to do. Could we do it? Could we partner? Could we work together on this?
Yeah.
And basically they said no. It was like, we could do the software, the networking stuff, you guys could do the hardware, we could team up, put out a product together. They said no. Then Bill met with Sony, same deal. Can we work together? Can we partner? And they said no. So that is true.
Interesting.
If anyone thought about buying Nintendo, I never heard that. So that's
rumor dispelled. There it is.
I mean, so, you ask Robbie that question, or ask someone else.
I'm going to try and get him in
Bill
here.
When you get Bill in here, ask him that.
He's a little busy saving the world right now to come in and do my dumb interview show.
Yeah, well, that's important too.
So rare.
So it's like all these things. I mean, I had been a big fan of their games, you know. I was actually a really big fan of Diddy Kong Racing for whatever reason. I loved that game. Conker's Bad Fur Day. They're just guys who, you know, there's only so many teams. As you know, when you go around this industry, there's only so many teams that do like,
that are special.
Super top.
Yeah.
Special work. Yeah. And so, you know, for me, it was always, it wasn't like we were going around, let's acquire all these people. It was like, how can we work with each different team?
Yeah.
Sometimes, like the Bungie guys, we didn't set out to acquire them. They called and said, we're going out of business. You know, it's like, okay, we will rescue you.
Yeah.
Right? In the case of Rare, they had an agreement with Nintendo where Nintendo owned half of Rare. And this was an agreement that was like 10 years old.
Yeah.
And Nintendo had an option to buy the other half of Rare. And that option was coming up. Now, I had met with the Rare guys before this. Just at that time, they were still fully in the
just
Nintendo
looking to
camp.
Work on something, maybe.
Because you never know what's going to happen, just so we know each other.
Right.
Right.
Why not?
You know, we all love games. We can sit around. We can talk games. Then they know who I am and, you know, what I'm about, and I know them. So, you know, maybe a year and a half, 2 years after that, you know, again, they call me up. They explain this arrangement that they have. They explain that Nintendo, it doesn't look like Nintendo's going to exercise their option.
Wow. After all the IPs and things that Rare built, that's interesting.
It was shocking to me. And having been through a bunch of these, my whole career is like, you know, battling 123, battling WordPerfect, you know. Now we're battling Sony and Nintendo, you know, and here's an opportunity where it's kind of like two birds with one stone kind of thing. You know, it's like, you know, okay, this is going to be expensive, but we're going to take away one of what I think is one of the best developers from our competitors. If we were just doing that, that would be one bird, you know. And then we're adding them to our team, two birds, you know.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Because theoretically, with what you're telling me now, with this whole option coming, Sony could have come in.
Absolutely.
And bought Rare instead.
In fact, Activision almost did.
I'm sure that would have ended well.
So we put in a bid, and then Activision outbid us, and it looked like we were going to lose the deal.
Huh.
And then at the very last minute, Robbie, increased our bid, and we won.
Wow!
And we won the deal, and yeah, that was it. And who knows what could have happened with Rare? You know,
are you in hindsight? Do you still feel good about the Rare deal?
It's sort of unfair for me to say, because I left soon after the deal completed.
Yeah.
And so, of course, like in my mind, if I was managing Rare, the Stamper brothers would still be there and they would have done cooler stuff and it would have all been great. I left and then they left soon after.
Yep.
You know, and so who knows what would have happened. It could easily have gone the other way, right? It could easily have just, maybe once we bought them, they made a lot of money and they would have left no matter what.
Right.
Who knows?
So then you leave. Early 2004, Ed Fries walks away. Xbox was just coming into its own, really, at that point.
Yeah.
We'd had, you know, the portfolio was really starting to grow. Ubisoft had done Splinter Cell exclusively for Xbox, which was just this amazing stealth game that the likes of which we hadn't seen before, really. You know, there was Metal Gear, but now there's Splinter Cell.
Yeah.
And then the 360 would have been on the drawing board back in early 2000. I read Robbie's book.
Oh, yeah.
Would have been back on the drawing board then. So
we were working on 360. I worked on 360 for a while before I left, yeah.
So I have a sense of what your answer to this question might be, because you've been hinting at your whole career is just one big battle after another. But so, yeah, well, respectfully, why do you leave at that point with the system coming into its own, the 360 on the horizon?
Yeah, it's complicated. And you know, it has to do with a lot of different things. I'm turning 40 at that time.
Yeah.
I've got one kid at home. I've got the second one on the way. I've been there almost 20 years. I made a lot of money, frankly.
Yeah, programmer number 7 on Excel.
Yeah.
That's a good gig to get in hindsight.
So these are the things on one side of the balance. On the other side, when I left office and went to work on games, I found myself in a situation where I had a huge amount of freedom to do whatever I wanted. And because no one cared. You remember that quote?
Yeah.
No one cared what I was doing. Okay. By the time we got Xbox out and it was proven to be a success,
Everyone cared.
It was like working on Office again. Everyone wanted to have a say about what we're doing and how we're going to do it. And they didn't know the game business like I knew the game business. And it was very frustrating for me. And an example is the Bungie story I told you.
Yeah.
Okay. We needed to take an extra year to do the next version of Halo. I meet with my boss, Robbie Bach, and say, we need to spend an extra year. And by the way, I enjoyed working for Robbie. We worked together almost a decade.
Yeah.
He was a great boss. I'm a product, you know, technology, game guy. He's a sales and marketing
the business
guy. Not really. I mean, okay. I ran the publishing business.
Right.
But I learned how to run a business from him in a lot of ways. So instead of saying, all right, we should take this extra year, he said, let's have a vote. So he brought in all his senior staff members, Jay Allard, Mitch Koch, other people you don't know, and went around the room. Should we force Bungie to ship on the original schedule because Halo is so important to the company, or should we give them the extra year that they want? Every person in the room voted we should force them to ship on the original schedule.
These guys don't see
except for me.
Yeah.
And I walked out of the room and I said, I will quit now if we don't give them this extra year.
They don't realize they're going to kill the whole IP by probably going to
the IP that is so important.
Right. Kill the golden goose.
Kill the golden goose. Marty likes to use that term, golden goose. It's a good one. And these are not dumb guys. They're very smart guys. But they didn't see the whole picture.
They apparently only ironically see things in spreadsheets.
And it was sad. It was a sad day. It was a day where I, for the first time, could see the future of where things were going.
Right.
And it was much more committee run and not necessarily a committee whose direction I agreed with. And
so where's the extra year come from?
Because I said I was going to quit right then.
That worked.
And it worked. It worked that time. But that was just one of a million things that are less. You can only threaten to quit so many times.
Right, right. You know what I mean? Wolf.
Right. It's like, okay, well, what about this next thing? What about this? Am I going to get to do what I think is right? Or are we going to have a vote? You know? Like I said, it's like a scale, right? I have all these things that I could be at home with my kids, having fun, playing games, doing what I want, you know, or I could be going to work every day, fighting these battles. And even though we were in a great spot, even though I had a great job, it was getting more and more frustrating.
You were in a position where you could.
And the draw of the other side was nice.
What would Ed Freeze's Xbox 360 have looked like?
It wouldn't have been that different. I think they did a great job on the 360. Robbie's strategy to launch a year earlier than everyone else, to keep the price low, worked very well, and Xbox grew its market share a huge amount in that time. So I think he made a lot of good strategic decisions around what he's really good at, marketing, positioning, that kind of thing. What would have happened with a software portfolio? Who knows? I had a great team of people who were running these projects, and they're still great whether I'm there or not. You know, so they continue to do a lot of great work. But, you know, whoever took over for me, you know, which I'm sorry, you know, then now they get to step into this political morass and they have to fight their way through it and try to do the right thing, which is hard, really hard.
What's your fondest memory of those Xbox days for you?
Probably the fondest memory for me is launch day, New York City,
Bill Gates handing over that first console?
Yeah, we're midnight launch, we're in Times Square, Xbox is up on all the screens, and, you know, it's just one of those moments in your life where you know you're like at this central point, you know. So it's great, great memory.
Do you have a favorite child, favorite Xbox, original Xbox game that just is sort of near and dear to your heart?
Well, you know, after I left, they canceled Psychonauts, and that was kind of a blow. And I spent some time down with Tim Schafer trying to help him work with them and get a good deal in the cancellation and make sure that that game found a home. Seamus actually helped a lot too, finding him a new publisher
agent at that time,
right? And so, Psychonauts is a title from that time. Psychonauts too. they did a nice little video history of Psychonauts. I did like a 3-part video. You know, that 2-player production.
Yeah, amazing those stuff. Documentaries are awesome.
Yeah, and they had me in it, and it was very kind to me about my role in the project and things like that. So yeah, I definitely backed it. And actually, I just because my 11-year-old hadn't played, so. You know, I got him the Steam version, and my 11-year-old is a connoisseur of games, by the way.
Nice.
He's a serious...
Chip off the old block.
He's a serious game critic. If you want opinions about what's wrong with your game...
We're probably hiring.
This is the
we
kid.
Might be hiring. Yeah,
this is the kid. That's what everybody's like. Can I hire him? Anyway, he just sat and played Psychonauts for 2 days straight, which means he loved the game, you know, because he has a million games to choose from. And it's just like, wow, this game still holds up.
So you were telling me before you came in, or before we got in the studio here, that, you know, you're big in the, you love retro games. You've been in this whole retro kick. Part of that, you made Halo 2600.
I did.
You made a Halo game as if it were for the Atari 2600.
The good thing
Please about, tell me that story.
The good thing
awesome.
About quitting your job is you can do whatever you want.
When you got that FU Excel money, you can make Atari games.
You know, so it's like, I went off, I was very close to the Blizzard people. I had tried to acquire them several times, and that's a whole other set of stories.
Wow.
But through that, I got to know them real well. And they got me into the early beta of World of Warcraft, and so I was a big World of Warcraft player, and then I started Fingerprints, which you and I were talking about before, 3D printing World of Warcraft characters, and just doing a lot of stuff during this time, a lot of advising, board member kinds of things, and that's what I still do today. I'm an advisor to game companies, sit on boards. But when you're an advisor, board member, it's like I love doing it because I stay connected.
Sure.
But at heart, I'm a builder. You know, I'm a maker of stuff. I still like to program. I still like to make
That's
things
great.
And have that joy of seeing it. You know, so I always have these crazy little projects going on the side. My kids know I call them procrastination projects. So it's like I have all this work I should be doing. Instead, I'm going to work on my procrastination project, right? So Halo was one of my procrastination projects, Halo 2600.
Yeah.
And it started, I was speaking at a conference in Philadelphia and I was talking about the old days working on the Atari 800. And somebody came up to me afterwards and they said, did you ever work on the 2600? That was 1977. I would have been 13. I never programmed on that. He said, well, you should read this book, Racing the Beam. Racing the Beam. It's named after staying ahead of the electron beam, okay, as it scans across. And so I read this book, and I was amazed, like, how difficult, compared to the Atari 800, it is to write a 2600 program.
So that's a challenge, then.
Yeah, it's got 128 bytes of memory. The sprites, if you can call them that, are a single byte, and you have to know where the electron beam is on every line, and you have to change them if you want each line to look different than the line after. Yeah, and I was just like, wow, I can't believe they could even make games on this system, you know? But, so I looked, and there's emulators, and there's assemblers, there's the equipment that you need online, the software that you need to play around. So I was like, okay, I'm just gonna put a sprite on the screen. You know, what am I going to do? And so I just opened Paint and I drew a little Master Chief. Okay. And because I couldn't think of anything else. And then I implemented the code to put it on the screen.
Yeah.
You know, and I got it working. And then I'm like, well, I could make him move around. You know, so then I write some code to make him move around. You know, then I write some code to have some alien guys. And then I write some code to shoot the aliens. Aliens to shoot back, you know, but it's just a goof. I'm just doing this.
Right.
You know, no intention of doing anything. Then I come down to GDC, and this would be 2010, and I just happen to run into, like, Mike Mica and Chris Charla, and they're standing there with Todd Fry, who worked on the 2600. Todd Fry did the Pac-Man for the Atari 2600, kind of an infamous project. But anyway, and they're like, hey, have you met Todd Fry? He worked on 2600. I'm like, you know, I'm dabbling with the 2600 myself at home. They're like, really? What are you doing? I'm like, well, I just did this Master Chief thing, you know. And they're like, oh, you have to do this. I'm like, I do? And they're like, no, you have to finish the game. Like, make that game. I was like, really? They're like, and yeah, Mike was like, I'll help you. You know, can I make some sprites for you? And I'm like, yeah, you know, I'm not really an artist. Yeah, I could use some help. You know, and they're like signing up to be my playtesters. And Ian Bogost is there, who wrote the book Racing the Beam, and so he's my playtester. And so they just encouraged me, and then you know, so I worked on the game, made it, really fleshed it out. You have only 4,000 bytes, 4K, to fit an entire game, and it has 64 rooms. You fight your way through, and then it has a big boss battle at the end. And squeezing that in 4K is really hard, but it's the kind of stuff I used to do.
Yeah,
you know. So there's a nostalgia element, and you know, released it at Classic Gaming Expo, and it got more excitement than I expected, and then things got really weird, because then what happened was Chris Melesinos was putting together the first video game art show for the Smithsonian American Art Museum. And he calls me up. He said, can I interview you for the thing? We're doing like a video of a bunch of game people.
Yeah.
Sure, I'll do that. And he takes some quote out of the video of mine where I talk and say, programming is like poetry, and he puts it on the wall of the thing, you know. But he's also like, can we include Halo 2600 as like just an example of homebrew? Because there was just examples of everything about the game. I'm like, sure, put it in there, you know. So the curator of the Smithsonian American Art Museum, after the show, is this huge success.
Sure.
It's like one of the biggest things they've ever put on, you know. So afterwards, he's looking through the collection, looking through the games, and he just falls in love with Halo 2600 because he thinks it's like sort of this ironic retro look at, you know, a future product and all this stuff. He's like, you know, can we add that to the permanent collection of the Smithsonian American Art Museum? You know, and I'm like, yes, you can. So anyway, so then it ended up being in an art show that they did later called Watch This 2 years later. Then they approached me last year and they said, will you join our board of commissioners to help us decide what new artworks we're going to bring into the American Art Museum because we want to bring more games.
You're definitely qualified for that.
And I said, yes, I will. So I have my first meeting for that next month.
Unbelievable.
I'm really excited about it.
You seem to just run into all the right people in your life, whether it's...
You know...
It's a charmed life. It's a good life.
There's a lot of serendipity in my life. There is. And, you know, I think you can... I think people can be too controlling about their lives. You know, I think if you, you know, it sounds like a cliche, but, you know, for me, it was, what are the things I love to do? What are the things I'm good at? Pursuing those and letting things work themselves out.
Before you go, I got to ask you what you think of, what do you think of the Xbox One and where you think the Xbox is going and where you'd like to see it go? You know, we've seen talk recently of, you know, is it going to become more PC-like with incremental hardware updates, the platforms being sort of opened a lot more. What do you think of the Xbox One and where you think it's headed and where you'd like to see it go?
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously they really stumbled on the launch. And really what happened was they sort of undid a bunch of the things that Robbie did with the 360.
Right.
You know, they didn't launch first. They launched at too high a price. And there were a bunch of other things we could talk about that have changed since then.
Yeah.
Right? Which is too bad. But fundamentally, it's a good product.
Absolutely.
And but it's also interesting to see what Sony did. Because Sony completely...
They made a 360, basically, right?
They did. I mean, the two products now are very similar. And they're both PCs, right? They're both back to where you were talking about, you know, that original vision. So... So I actually like both consoles. I think they're great. I have both, you know, and we play different games on them, like any hardcore gamer probably does. So the other important thing is, I think, that to talk about Phil Spencer for a minute. You know, Phil Spencer is somebody I recruited into the group long ago. When I decided to quit Microsoft, I had 1,200 people working for me. One person walked into my office and said, "Should I quit too?" And that was Phil Spencer.
Wow.
And I said, like, "No, Phil, you don't have to quit. It's okay. You should do what you want to do. You should stay and make this stuff better." So he's a great guy, you know, a ton of loyalty, obviously. And I was really happy to see him go into that role. And I think that he's done a great job of fixing things. I mean, a great example is this recent thing, this opening up Xbox Live for cross-platform play. I hope that Sony is going to respond likewise. I'm a big fan of Shuya Yoshida at Sony as well.
And a great leader there.
He's been a great guy, loves games. And it's good to see some of the war kind of ramping down and more kind of respect and cooperation between those two groups. So I'm very optimistic for the future of both companies.
Well, Ed Fries, thank you so much. Your plug real quick, you've got this whole retro kick going on. Where can we read and see all of your things you've got going on?
Well, so now I'm getting into like 2600 wasn't old enough, so now I'm going back to the very, very beginnings of the video game business. So I started with Computer Space, and you can read a blog I wrote called Fixing Computer Space, if you just look for that. It's edfries.wordpress.com. But I have several more queued up after that I'm like in the process of writing. I'm not really a writer, but You'll see. It has lots of pictures, and I bought a completely broken Computer Space machine, which for people who don't know, was the very first arcade game.
Right.
The very first commercial arcade game. It was made by Nolan Bushnell the year before he started Atari. So anyway, did a Space Wars, did a Pong. I'm working on a game called Space Race right now, which is the third arcade video game ever made, and I would geek out. If I say anything more, it's going to be like a half hour of me geeking out about this stuff. But it's really fun. It's really fun for me to go back to the very, very early days when people made video games just out of simple chips. And maybe I'll build my own.
That'd be awesome. Why not? It seems to be in your DNA. It's what you do.
Yeah.
Ed Fries, the man responsible for getting Halo onto the Xbox, and so many, many other games that are in your portfolio. I learned a lot. I had a great time. Thank you so much for stopping by.
Happy to do this.
And, of course, for more episodes of IGN Unfiltered, be sure to look on IGN on YouTube or on iTunes. We do these each and every month with the best, brightest, and most interesting folks in the game industry. So, Ed, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hello, friends. This is Mark Nell, executive producer of the Table Read podcast, where imagination meets performance. As we wrap up an incredible season one, we want to take a moment to express our heartfelt gratitude to each and every one of you who tuned in and supported us on this amazing journey. Season one was nothing short of extraordinary. We delved into captivating scripts that transported us to worlds beyond our imagination, thanks to the brilliant writers who delivered these works. But what really brought these stories to life were the talents of our amazing actors. But wait, the excitement doesn't end there. As we bid farewell to season one, we are thrilled to announce the launch of season two. Get ready for more gripping narratives, more unforgettable characters, and more mesmerizing performances that will keep you on the edge of your seat. We have some big surprises coming. The Force will definitely be with you. So stay tuned, stay engaged, and most importantly, stay excited. From all of us at the Table Read Podcast, thank you. And let's make season two even more memorable together.